Coming up on Across the Chains, the Stablecoin Spectacular. Is it actually possible to make a decentralized algorithmic stablecoin that doesn't eventually destroy itself? Or are we forever condemned to fiat-backed things like USDC and Tether? Well, my guest today is Justin Bibas, and we are going to spend the full hour discussing all of the attempts to date on Across the Chains.
They take your money, then they take you down with them. Let's do better together. ERN, extremely resilient, naturally.
Onboard here, pay gas. Bridge there, pay gas. Deposit, harvest, withdrawal, pay gas. And God forbid you haven't verified every contract along the way. DeFi can be a real hassle sometimes, but with Rainmaker, it doesn't have to be. Rainmaker's new wallet makes it simple by extracting away all the worst parts. No more bad transactions, no more gas fees. MPC technology makes private key management as simple as classic password recovery while maintaining self-custody. Pick your strategies and invest with one click. Deposit funds directly from your bank account. To access the Rainmaker app, click the link in our description. Put in the code BLOCKBYTES.
Wow, look at us with ads in the show now, right before the right before we start. Moving on up.
Yeah, hello, we're professional operation. Hey, Mark, how are you?
Doing? Corvallis. How you doing, Justin?
Doing good.
So today is our what do you got? You drinking some another ad here?
Canned coffee, UCC brand, in my opinion.
Very nice.
The best.
Not very a show nice. Sponsor. That is That is Bibas's drink
that
of choice.
That's Bibas's drink. So so today we're doing the Stablecoin Spectacular. You guys ready for this?
Oh, I'm excited.
I'm excited as well. All right. Well, I figure let's just dive into the deep end and get going here. So I'm going to start off with kind of the lay of the land, the, you know, the state of the union, lay of the land. So this is – so in total, in aggregate, there's a roughly $128 billion worth of stable coins out there. And the breakdown, I'm on the wrong thing here. The breakdown of how much, so most of it is Tether, right? So a big blue area is Tether. The next biggest lump here is USDC. And this used to be a lot larger. USDC used to be a bigger, much bigger part of this pie chart until the Silicon Valley Bank collapse, because USD is backed by fiat in Silicon Valley Bank. I'm not sure if that's true now, but they probably moved it by now, but that's where it was. So there was all this speculation that that fiat was going to go away and it was going to be unbacked. And so USDC shrank quite a bit. And then the rest of the pie is just sort of a mishmash of lots of other things, including FRAX and GUSD and LUSD, et cetera. This is sort of the ranking, just another view of that pie chart. You know, obviously Tether at the top, Magic Internet Money down here near the bottom, unfortunately for it. It used to be kind of up here near FRAX. Actually, it used to be more than FRAX for quite a large amount of its life until the whole Danny and Sifu thing, and now it's down at the bottom and it's never recovered. It's kind of hard to see there. This is a quick look at the curve pool. So I have a couple different theses that we'll discuss during the show. One of them is that, what makes a stable coin worth $1? And in my mind, if it's worth $1 on Curve, it's worth $1. And by that, I mean you can exchange $1 of whatever stablecoin for $1 worth of another stablecoin on Curve at large volume, like, 10 million or whatever. And the converse is also true. If you lose your peg, if you're worth less than a dollar on Curve, Luna, Terra, like Terra lost its peg on Curve. And when it started to severely depeg and then went down to zero, this was the battlefield on which that happened. So if you lose your peg on Curve severely enough and for long enough, you're dead. So this is the health of the pools as they exist right now. The three pool being probably the biggest and most important one for stable coins, is it's a mashup. It's basically DAI, USDC, and Tether. And that's got about 300 million in it. So that's pretty healthy. LUSD also relatively healthy at 23 million. SUSD, I don't know. Do you know what that is, Beavis? I actually don't know what this
is. That is Synthetics USD. So it's used to back the Quinta Perpetuals platform.
Got it. Okay. And that's about 56 million, right? So this is how much money is in there for liquidity to exchange between these coins. Frax is in really good shape at 172 million. It's almost, you know, it's like, it's about half of the three pool, right? So that's pretty good. MIM is still at 80 million, which is not terrible, but it's, you know, again, a shadow of its former self. So that's sort of the lay of the landscape that we're dealing with right here. Mr. Beavis, you are an expert at all things stablecoin. And you were speaking to me about the stablecoin trilemma the other day. So why don't you talk to us about that? Tell us what that is.
Yeah. So in stablecoin design, you are fighting against three big trade-off spaces. So one, you have decentralization, which of course is a spectrum from, you know, minted and managed by the CIA to, you know, nobody can touch this in a million years, being like, let's say, USDC over to LUSD. And then you have peg safety. So peg safety being how hardcore is your algorithm? How hardcore is your collateral backing? How over-collateralized are you in general? And, you know, how efficient are you? Those kind of playing against peg safety. So there you have, you know, a DAI or again, an LUSD all the way to the other end to like a Terra Luna or things.
So just so people know, peg safety is your ability to maintain your stablecoin at exactly or pretty close to $1, right? Yes. So that's what you mean by that. And then the collateralization, some of these stablecoins are backed by fiat in a bank, like there's actually dollars in Wells Fargo. That Tether is the, you know, prime example of that. Then there are other coins that are backed by other coins, right? Yes. Other crypto. And so that is what you're speaking of when you talk about collateral safety, I think, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like a really volatile backing, like backing something with Ethereum versus backing something with US dollars versus backing something with Dogecoin are going to have different outcomes because the volatility of the underlying collateral really changes the value of the debt asset significantly over time. And then the last one, which is at odds with the other two most of the time, is scalability. So how well can you address the market? You know, something like LUSD, it's taken years and years to get to the 100 millions as one of the top decentralized applications. And something like Circle or something like Tether, they can just mint $1 billion of assets in a moment because, you know, they're pulling from the fractional reserve banking system and creating leverage, creating cash is much easier. And these three things being scalability, decentralization, and peg stability are always fighting against each other in the design process because something that's fully decentralized only uses volatile collaterals that are native to a chain or similar, that's going to be much, much, much harder to pull liquidity in and pull capital in for because one, not as much exists, and two, you're occupying a very specific use case. So the actual obtainable market may be narrower. Whereas, you know, if you look at peg stability at being at odds with scalability, it's really easy to scale if you look at something like Terra Luna when you're just giving out the stable coins, not for free necessarily, but you're essentially, you know, creating a flywheel to allow the total supply to inflate. There's no collateral backing, so it's much easier to produce them. So
there's no governing belt on it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And ended up being an issue.
Peg stability is not the jam there. You always as a designer need to look at these different aspects of a stablecoin and figure out where exactly you're going to fit into the grand scheme of things.
Okay, so let's rewind back to sort of the beginning of crypto. you know, roughly 2013 or something like that. I remember hanging out in Brock Pierce's office here in LA, and they were talking about the invention of Tether. And Tether was the first stablecoin. And I remember thinking, that's dumb. Why do you want to put a dollar on a blockchain? We've already got Bitcoin. Like, it defeats the purpose. You're like, in my mind at that time, it was like, that defeats the purpose of crypto, right? Now, of course, what I was not understanding was, you know, everything related to stablecoins, basically, primarily that there were all these overseas exchanges, like at the time, Mt. Gox, et cetera. And in order to get your Bitcoin, you had to wire money through the old banking system. That was like the only way you could do transactions on these old exchanges, right? So you'd wire your money to Japan, which took like 10 days, right, or something, and it would get there, hopefully. And then you could buy your Bitcoin and send it back to yourself instantly, or leave it up on the exchange if you were dumb. Now, Tether came along, and all of a sudden, we didn't have to deal with the wire transfers. Tether was the lingua franca of overseas exchanges, right? So now, within a minute, you know, within you know, a couple minutes, you had dollars moved to that exchange and you could transact. That was an insanely great invention. That was the killer app for Tether. And that's why one of my theses is you need a killer app for your stablecoin. That's why Tether took off. You agree, Beavis?
I definitely agree that you, if not a killer app, you need a killer use case. You know, there's a lot of in crypto making a solution for a problem that doesn't exist. So I think if you can make a solution for a problem that's very apparent, then that's a big win. And whether it be an application, you know, suiting some user's needs, or whether it be an enterprise need like with Tether, 100% you need that killer use case. Otherwise, what's the point?
Could you say that Tether was really successful because of like a first mover advantage too? Like, I mean, there was no competition when it first opens up, right? In that stable.
Yeah, without a doubt. That was, you know, a big part of it. Then along comes USDC, and they are the button down Tether, right? So there were a lot of questions about Tether. Were they shady? Did they really, really have the backing in the bank that they said they did? Were they playing games? Nobody knows for sure one way or the other. But you know, USDC came along and they said, we're going to be the Boy Scout squeaky clean version of Tether. And so, you know, they have, you know, Jeremy Allaire is the guy behind that. And so everybody knew him, and, they fired up and started going, they were another Tether. Right. So, but basically didn't really improve upon the design other than, through legitimacy, right. That was their innovation. So there was that whole thing. And then along came DAI, and DAI was the first stablecoin to be backed entirely by other crypto assets. So the big innovation there was DAI was not connected in any way directly to the fiat banking system. There was no Wells Fargo bank account. It existed completely natively in the crypto universe. Any thoughts on that, Beavis?
I mean, DAI, originally called Psi, by the way. It got a lot of buy-in from decentralization maximalists, Ethereum maximalists, as, hey, here is a killer app potentially for Ethereum. Here is something that suits our ethos a lot better than USDC or USDT. And it got a ton of buy-in. And then its killer use case became, hey, we're the decentralized stablecoin. We're the stablecoin that doesn't invalidate the crypto thesis. So obviously, tons of buy-in, lots of affinity with Ethereum, lots of affinity with early DeFi, Curve, Uniswap. And now, of course, it occupies a really huge seat in the stablecoin market.
So if I want to mint DAI, I show up with some other crypto asset, and I go to, I guess, the DAI site. I've actually never done this. I've done this with other stable coins, but I've never done it with DAI. So I assume I show up much like these other sites with my crypto assets, wrap Bitcoin, Ethereum, whatever. I put it into DAI, and then it mints. Basically, that's collateral, and then it mints me some of the DAI stablecoin. Is that correct?
Yeah. And thanks to what I can assume is, at this point, a labyrinthine legal structure, you would actually go to an unaffiliated app that they have on the MakerDAO homepage called Oasis, where you can create a vault. And now they're creating more apps. I think one is called Spark, which is basically an Aave fork, except the only thing you borrow is DAI right off their debt ceiling. So there are a lot of ways to mint DAI, and MakerDAO has kind of become just an issuer, where it's like, hey, here's this app, we're going to issue them some DAI to meet out to the public. I mean, they've been accruing real world assets and centralization along the way. Many argue that they've lost the plot, but they're really successful. One of the most successful DeFi companies out there.
I mean, they're huge. I mean, it's I agree that there's a lot of people who make fun of them. Like a lot of people say it's a failure because it's effectively become wrapped USDC because most of the backing of DAI is USDC, which is kind of true. Right. But also, it's still one of the major stable coins. So it absolutely is still, here among us. So pretty cool. All right. So the next sort of innovation I think that I've saw is MIM, Magic Internet Money, right, which can be found at the abracadabra.money site. And it was meant to be sort of an improvement on DAI, but using sort of the same model. And they allowed you to show up with 30 or so different yield bearing assets as collateral that you put into abracadabra.money. And these yield bearing assets are things like, Aave, where you borrow coins. When you deposit your coins into Aave, you get tokens back, which represent your coins plus the interest they're earning when Aave lends those coins out to someone else. So those tokens are yield bearing assets. You could use those as collateral in abracadabra.money to mint MIM, which was a stable coin, right? And basically it was 1.5x backed. So whatever you put in there, you could borrow 66%, or is that right? If I'm doing that right. But you could borrow, you couldn't borrow more than 66% of whatever you put in there. And once if you started edging up towards like 70%, they would liquidate you. So what was cool about that is that there were 30 different assets. So it had a wide variety of things backing it. So if one of those assets failed, which some of them have, like you used to be able to use Terra as one of the assets, and Terra completely failed. So that bucket of backing is 100% gone, right? Mm-hmm. But it doesn't matter because there's 29 more. Plus, the entire thing is 1.5x backed. So if you sort of, so it's very resilient. So it's fine. It's solvent.
Yeah.
Right. And so, so that was kind of a cool innovation, but it required another party to perform the liquidation. So it wasn't like MIM liquidated itself whenever those collateralized debt positions reached the level required for them to be liquidated. Right. So, but Beavis, I know you have some thoughts on MIM, so tell us what you think.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think MIM was the first big DeFi 2.0 stablecoin. Being DeFi 2.0 was all about creating yield instruments, wrapping up some of the DeFi primitives of DeFi 1.0, being the 2020 era, wrapping those up and giving you new utility. So first, they started out as being a really great way to leverage these interest-bearing assets, loop them in a lot of cases, and go long in some other cases. And then they started diverting, and I think this is where, in my opinion, they went wrong, from the we're the DeFi 2.0 lending platform to the we're the exit liquidity for people with things like Shiba or Ohm or FTT. And they started taking on all this counterparty risk as a means to eat up market share, because people weren't using it as a stable coin. People were using it as an instrument to create leverage and to exit illiquid positions.
Let's zero in on that, because I think that's a really good point. I think you're right. So I think Tether was legitimately used as a stable coin. Same with USDC, same with DAI. MIM was not really a commonly used stable coin, except with degenerates, right? So people... And the point you made, you talked about looping. So let's talk about what that is. So here we're looking at abracadabra.money. Algorand can be used as a as one of the one of the coins that you can deposit to generate MIMs. So what people would do is that they would deposit their Alchemex or whatever, get their MIMS, then go back and buy some more Algorand or Alchemex, and then use that as collateral, deposit it to mint some MIMS, which they would then use to go buy some Algorand or Alchemex, which, you know, so they would basically do, and you could keep doing this. The pile of MIMS would get smaller each time, but you could effectively create something like, I guess, 3x leverage, something like that.
Using in some cases, over 5x.
Jesus Christ.
But yeah, and AGLD, I think that's actually...
Adventure Gold. That's Adventure Gold. Sorry.
Adventure Gold.
Yes. It's not Algorand. Sorry. Yeah, Adventure Gold. Yeah, I forgot about that.
But yeah, and it really worked well, and people loved it, and it created like a community of, you know, when you say degen, it's really just... You know, this person doesn't have a ton of money, but they want the money that they do have to go as far as they possibly can. And there were some whales that were messing around too. But when you're like floating around these illiquid pools, floating through these illiquid assets, you know, you need tools designed to suit your skill set. And MIM did that exactly, or not their skill set, but your portfolio. And MIM did that, and they did a really good job. And honestly, like as far as being able to unwind and manage these toxic assets that they took on, they've done a really freaking good job. Like,
I agree.
It, like high stress, like unwinding FTT, unwinding Olympus, unwinding UST, you know, it's shown a surprising amount of resilience, the MIM token.
So wait, let me stop you there because I want to make sure people understand this. So when you say unwind these things, so everybody's familiar with Terra Luna and how that thing crashed spectacularly, went from like a crazy amount of money to zero basically in 48 hours. And MIM was wrapped up in that whole thing, right? It was that one of the assets you could use was Terra. So the idea, you know, the fear was that... that as Terra destroyed itself, it would take down MIM with it because MIM was using it as backing, right? So could it liquidate those positions that were shrinking in value fast enough, right? And did that matter? And there were so many destruction fests in DeFi over the course of 2022, and MIM in particular, it did depeg, like, so it became worth less than a dollar. It went down to like 93 cents for like a day, and then it popped back up to a dollar. So it was extraordinarily resilient at extreme stress multiple times. That was actually I'm with you, Beavis. That was incredibly impressive, yeah. Right? Yeah. So, yeah.
And I think it goes to, you know, the technical merits of the Abracadabra team. You know, you look at OX Merlin, you look at Boring Crypto. I mean, these are really legendary engineers in the space. And they created a system that was able to isolate these pools of debt. And, you know, the way they manage the debt table, like you said, like constantly ensuring that there was no serious concentration risk, ensuring that most of the collateral was made up of quality assets. You know, when you're collateralized that much, you can take a hit here and there, and they're designed to absorb impact. I mean, and so much of the stablecoin market is like purity tests, and everybody wants to be like, oh, our stablecoin is the most pure, beautiful, you know, virgin stablecoin. And it's like, dude, these are all just financial instruments, and there's, you know, an entire spectrum of market share for them to occupy. You know, if everybody was just liquidity or everybody was just DAI, it would be boring as hell. And, you know, I'm glad that MIM kind of created a new sort of outlook for a lot of stablecoin enjoyers, we'll call them.
Enjoyers. Yes. So basically we're talking about when you're saying that spectrum, this is just like, people use stablecoins for all kinds of different purposes, right? Some people use them like USDC and Tether, a lot of people will just want to maybe get out of some of the volatility of crypto at the moment. So they want to move into an asset that they can immediately use to buy real world goods, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then you have MIM where you want to get yield, you want to leverage, you want to go crazy.
Yeah. And the collateral backing, like, people are always like, oh, another stable coin. There are so many stable coins. And it's like, one, it's the largest addressable market by far in DeFi. And two, there is infinite room in the market. Like, you know, risk profile here. And the bigger the market is as the biggest market. So the more DeFi grows, the more room for these different types of products there will be. And I think like we're going to see stablecoins, debt-backed currencies, whatever you want to call them, everywhere. And we're going to always see them, and we're going to see more and more, and the appetite will not ebb because,
agreed,
you know, debt-backed currency has been used for thousands of years. If you look at promissory notes, you know, merchants would issue promissory notes to people so they could, you know, go out and sell their wares or you know, sell something or do something using that backing. Banknotes, you know, those have been used for hundreds of years as a representative of some holding in a bank. And even checking accounts are literally just a note saying, hey, you are owed this amount of collateral of our entire portfolio, which is, surprise, not all cash, believe it or not.
Yeah.
You don't just store big mountains of cash. So, you know, as many banks as you see on the street, you know, we're going to see as many stable coins because that is the analog for crypto. And, you know, we have so much flexibility, so many different types of assets, so many different risk profiles, even in its brand new nascent state with 50 to 100,000, you know, active users. There's going to be room for hundreds of these things. So just imagine, like, you know, you'll walk down your digital alleyway and you'll see a new stable coin. Oh, a new stable coin. That wasn't there yesterday. You'll walk down some more. Anybody with a bank account could you know, make their own stable coin and it could find a use case for it. So,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it's exciting.
Let me move along here because I want to hit Bean and then I want to move on to LUSD. And Beavis is saying, yeah, I know, because I don't know if you guys know much about Bean. But before we do that, just real quick. So here's sort of the market caps of a couple of these stable coins. Magic Internet Money, there was nearly $5 billion worth of it. And today it's down to like $80 million. So, you know, but kind of a spectacular crash. So it never really recovered from its all-time highs. This is Liquity. Liquity is doing well. It's not really growing crazily, but it's absolutely captured the attention of, I think, the intelligentsia of crypto and stablecoins in particular. It's being basically the best design of the decentralized stablecoins to date. I think we can debate this, but I think we agree on that. The next one, USDC. So this had a rather spectacular run-up to, you know, $55 billion or so. And this is pretty much the Silicon Valley Bank fiasco. USDC put their fiat backing into Silicon Valley Bank, right? That was the safe choice. And when Silicon Valley Bank evaporated kind of overnight, everybody went, oh, shit. Maybe fiat banking in one of these bank accounts is not so safe, right? And everybody moved their money to Tether. Everybody was like, well, Tether's safer than USDC. Which nobody had that on their bingo card at all, right?
Yeah.
I don't think, right? So yeah. That was pretty crazy. Mm-hmm. And of course, Tether, you know, Tether was rising pretty fast and it had a little bit of a drop off. And this is everybody running back into it after, you know, the Silicon Valley Bank fiasco. So that's pretty crazy. Okay. I want to move us on along to Bean here so we have enough time to kind of do Beavis' stuff. So I don't know what you guys know about this, so I'm going to run through it pretty quickly. Beanstalk is another take on how to do a stablecoin. So we've had the fiat-backed, we've had the crypto-backed. What about a coin that's backed by nothing? So it's basically a credit-based, self-booting stablecoin asset, right? So I don't know if this is a good idea or not, but it is an interesting idea for sure. So its market cap right now is at around 35 million. It was as high as almost 80 million, and then it got hacked. So all of its liquidity got drained from it. It was about $70 million worth. They raised like another, I think it was like 25 million to kind of reboot the whole system. So even though their market cap is around 35 million, their actual backing is quite a bit less. Now it lost peg for quite a long time. I watch it pretty regularly. So it was hanging out at around 85 cents, 90 cents for 6 months or something like that. And just a few days ago, it recently reattained its peg, which is kind of interesting. And the way it did that was, so the mechanism, the way it works is basically there is something called the pod line, and it's sort of like treasury bonds where you first of all mint your beans, and I'm going to talk about how you do that in a minute. You mint your beans, and then you loan it back to the protocol, and you loan it back in individual positions called pods. And there's a big long line of them, and it's first in, first out, and it's basically debt based. And they basically say whatever your interest rate is when you come into the pod line, later on you'll get that out plus your interest rate. And the interest rate, if the protocol is starving, is very large. So at this point in time, the interest rate was 15,000% in the pod line. And so someone just loaned 30K to the protocol, right? But they're way in the back of the pod line. They might not ever see that again, right? And in fact, I got to be honest, it's pretty likely. So, but if by some miracle Bean takes off, they'll make $5 million off of 30K. Right, when it does come back out the other end. So that's the bet. So this is sort of there's all kinds of intricacies to this one. And I don't like that. I think it's too complicated. But you can see exactly what's going on through the intricacies. And basically the field is how you enter into their universe. This 15,000%, that's the interest rate of entering the pod line. And then these are the assets that you give it to enter to get your bean. To loan back to the protocol to enter the pod line. And those assets include Bean itself, ETH, Wrapped ETH, 3Curve, DAI, USDC, and Tether. What do they use these for? They use it for liquidity on Curve. So this basically goes right back into Curve liquidity pools. That's right, because that's how you maintain your dollar peg. If it's a dollar on Curve, then it's a dollar. And the more liquidity you have in there, the easier it is to maintain that peg. Also, when you enter the pod line, you're not just stuck there. You can sell your position. So the positions are in fact, sellable. And this is the market for selling your pod position early, right? So that guy that put 30K in that will make 5 million theoretically, you know, about halfway through, he might be like, I'm not really feeling good about this. So I'm going to sell my position for 1 million and I'll sell it, you know, when I'm halfway through and somebody might come along and take that bet, right? So this is the pod line sort of, marketplace here. So this is, I'm sure if I remember what this is. Oh, this is Curve. So this is the Curve pool for Bean. And this has got like about, 24 million of liquidity in it. Remember that the entire protocol is worth 35 million. So there's less liquidity in Curve than the entire protocol is worth. It's a little bit scary, right? But this is, you know, it's made up roughly half of Bean, and then divided into roughly thirds of DAI, USDC, and Tether. Forget what that is. Blah, 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 blah. Okay. Oh, right. This is my position. So embarrassingly enough, I entered into Bean back in its heyday. I didn't enter the pod line, but I did enter the silo. I entered with 29K worth of Bean 3Curve liquidity.
Oh, no.
So I'm still there, Mark. Right? Yeah, so I mean, look, come on, we've all had these things, right? So, yeah. So it's worth $383 right now. But like, I like to be transparent about these things, right? When they go That's great, awesome. And then when they don't go great, and this is one of those that didn't go so great, right? So, so here's where it's rebooted. So basically, there's Bean, and then there's Bean 3Curve LP, Unripe Bean, and Unripe Bean. There's another pool they started, basically a separate pod line. For the people that gave them the 20 million or so to reboot the protocol, right? So we're basically the old pod line and the new pod line are kind of splitting the difference as,
oh God.
As right. So that's how they've rebooted, right? So that's kind of what we're looking at here. So anyway, so Beebus, thoughts on this? Have you seen this? What do you know about this?
It's super dope. I would never use it, but I will be an observer until the end of time. I think, you know, you look at Basis Cash and everything that came out of Basis Cash, you know, your Terra Luna's, your Tomb Finance, your Myth Cash, your Empty Set Dollar, all that stuff. The more successful it is, the likelier it is to fail, I think, is really the issue with this stuff. And it's kind of like more people are sitting on more profit. They're sitting on more Bean. And people look at it as a stable coin. And the thing about a stable coin, it's either, you know, you have a static supply and a variable price, or a variable price or and a static supply. Did I say that right? You either have a static price or a static supply, you know, and the other aspect is variable. So yeah. People look at a stable coin and they don't immediately think in traders' terms, because they don't see volatility on the chart or whatever. But you do need to think about it that way, because the supply in the best traders are going to have a supply that's constantly increasing, and the worst traders are going to have a supply that's decreasing. And that isn't told very well by the chart. So you can't assess these things very well. And the bigger they get, it's like a really high market cap. You're going to have the early entrants, the people who threw in these pods at 30,000% APR or whatever. They're going to be on that other end with so much Bean, and they're going to want to realize that to USDC, you know, no off-ramp is ever going to accept Bean. You're not going to be able to get a Subway sandwich with Bean. You know, any level of due diligence, you know, any risk manager is going to be like, oh, you know, of course not. So you just need to think about it in that way. It's like, and I guess one other aspect to this is it requires immense coordination and immense buy-in from the community, like to the degree that you need to be selfless. And we've existed in society, you know, we know that's not really how especially people with trading acumen are. So it's an awesome experiment. It's something that I love to watch. It's just, you know, people use stablecoin as a misnomer, as a little, you know, red herring, when there's really nothing that stable about it. You know, it's like the amount of collateral backing or the fundamental value is always shifting. It's just shifting in a way that people aren't used to. And that's very hard to assess. So it's like, if you're not an absolute expert, if you're buying in just for the community, if people bring you in and are like, oh, dude, we love you. We love you. You know, it's probably because they, you know, they're bringing you into the slaughter. So I've become very careful about anything like that, because even I have a hard time analyzing it, and it's kind of my job. Yeah. And it's like, there's not enough data. The data isn't packaged well enough. It's like, you can, you know, make some high level assessments, but, you know, actually digging into the true value takes a lot of time.
Yeah. And one thing I want to say is, like, look, you have to be on the field and playing in order to make the money, in order to learn. Right. Yeah. So Mark Cuban uses the wallets. He loses money. Jason Calacanis makes a lot of bets on angel companies. He loses a lot of money. And then every once in a while, he makes a shit ton of money. Right. So this is the game that we all play. Yeah. The last time I went in on something, some crazy Russian guy pitched me on his chain and coin. And it seemed like, and he was going to give me, you know, his coin a year and a half after I gave him a bunch of very precious Bitcoin. His name was Vitalik Buterin. That was the Ethereum ICO. And that worked out. So sometimes you think, like, that did not look like a good bet on the surface, right?
Yeah.
You know, some Russian guy you've never heard of, hey, give me your Bitcoin, right? Pretty much what it felt like, right? But as I listened to him, there was enough there that I was like, that is interesting. The Bean guys also, it sounds interesting.
It's awesome. It's
very innovative. Mm-hmm. There's a lot there to like, right? So it didn't work, but.
If they haven't gotten exploited, you probably would be doing victory laps right now.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, that is probably the difference. So,
well, the complexity of the system kind of opens it up to that, right? Like more smart contract risk. You know, I'd prefer if it was backed by Bean futures.
That's effectively what the
pod line would be cool.
Yeah, I mean, really, that is kind of the pod line. So, all
right, I think he means beans, like actual beans, like
legumes. Yeah, like legumes. Kind of,
you mean actual beans? Got it. I'm picking up what you're laying down.
I think people just need to realize, and I think they do for the most part. Like, all of us have taken our licks. Anybody who hasn't realized it by now is either, you know, out or they're doing something else. You just need to realize it's a risk. It's a trade. You're trading yield as opposed to trading, for price volatility. You're trading yield volatility, and it's like buying an option. It's like, hey, if we're successful, you get a ton of money. And that also motivates the community side of things, where it's like, oh, hey, I'm at the end of this pod line. I need to become an ultimate maxi to push mine to the front, until I can finally exit. And it's the same thing with every type of VC, every type of investing, trading, whatever. It's like, it's in your best interest to support the protocol, and that's what they depend on. And I think the thing that always sucks is it's always going to be in someone's best interest, especially as the protocol matures. Maybe there are new ways to lend something, short it, et cetera. It's always going to be in someone's best interest to do the opposite and topple the protocol.
Yeah.
And we're in an antagonistic environment, and not everybody really cares about everybody else's well-being or happiness or wealth or what have you.
It's a coin world.
It is a coiny coin world. As much as the coins are lovely and fun.
It is. Coiny coin world. All right. So I want to interrupt you because I want to talk more about you and your project and your stuff.
No.
So let's just talk in general about liquidity. So, after MIM, there was some MIM was great, but there were some issues with it. Not least of which you and I discussed, Beavis, in a separate conversation, the liquidation is kind of an issue. So it's possible that, if you have a very sharp wick down of one of the collateralized assets, that the liquidation of those assets does not happen fast enough for the protocol to remain solvent. So it might wick down so fast that you can't get, you can't sell the stuff on the open market. A, that's one problem. Second problem is that you need an outside party to actually perform the liquidations within the protocol. And it's very difficult to do on MIM. It's not like an end user can do it. It has to be a software, engineer type person or a bot. And sometimes those positions, just nobody decides to liquidate them because nobody notices.
Because it's not profitable is what happens. Like, because a lot of times these assets dip and it's like the books thin instantly. Everybody's selling, everybody's going crazy, everybody's trying to, recover loss. And suddenly, when you underwrote an asset, you're like, oh, it's right here, it's epic. And then one block later, it's like, oh, wow, I have just made a mistake.
Yeah. So that's a problem, right? So it's definitely a threat to the entire well-being of the system. So along comes liquidity, and they'd invent something. So instead of liquidating to the market, they invent something called the stability pool. And this acts as sort of like a buffer zone between the protocol and the open market. And when a position is liquidated, it doesn't go to the market. All the collateral goes into the stability pool. And the stability pool is 1.5x collateralized at all times. And it basically absorbs that asset. And I'm trying to think of a good way to describe what it does with it.
It buys it back.
It buys it back, and then it burns the corresponding amount of stable coins so that there aren't any unbacked stable coins still out there floating around in the world. So it maintains the integrity of the collateral backing of the LUSD stable coin. And right, so this is a kind of a really good invention, the stability pool.
Yeah, it kind of turns liquidations into a third party effort that relies on P&L, that relies on all this different stuff, into a integral effort, or into an effort that's like actually part of the protocol. And the cool thing about that, and the stability pool, generally you want between 30 and 50% of all of the circulating stable coins in that pool. So that, generally you're not going to have more than that. I'm not going to get into all of the aspects of liquidity because you'll probably go crazy. But essentially, like, if you stake in the stability pool, not only do you get yield just through token emissions or what have you, but you will be buying back discounted assets from the protocol in the event that a position becomes unhealthy. So if the collateralization ratio of Ethereum is 110%, if a liquidation happens, you'll lose an equal portion or like a percent portion of your position, and you'll gain at a 10% discount that Ethereum. So a lot of people treat it as a way.
I think a lot of people just got lost, because I took me a while to sort of clue into this too. And I know you deal with this every day. So there's two things to be aware of. So first is first of all, Liquity only accepts Ethereum as collateral, right? That's it. It's only one asset. It's not like Mem where there's 30. There's just one. It's Ethereum. So you show up with your Ethereum and you say, all right, I want to create some LUSD. Here is $100 $110 worth of Ethereum. And then the system goes, great, you can mint $100 worth of LUSD. So it has a 110% collateralization ratio, which is really low, right? So things like MIM, it's 150%. It's 1.5x more or less, right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of the norm. So so this thing, you're like, holy shit, 110%? That feels dangerous. And the reason why is because the system wants liquidations. The system, the lifeblood of this system, this design, is liquidations. So if you want, you want to play with the piranha, have a good time at that 110%. Really, you should collateralize at 150% anyway. But of course, a lot of people take advantage of that. They get liquidated quickly and frequently. But there are some use cases for which that's actually extremely capital efficient. So what Bibas is just saying is that one of the things that the protocol invites users to do, one of the use cases of LUSD, your stable coins, is that you can put it into the stability pool, sort of like you would have put it into Anchor in Terra Luna. And you're basically going to more or less be guaranteed somewhere between 5 to 10% APY on your stable coins, which is, pretty good yield for a stable coin. And where that's coming from is when the positions are liquidated, right? It's 100 to 10% collateralization ratio. Well, that 10% is what you're all getting, right? So if you're in the stability pool, you get it from those people who get liquidated.
Yeah, and the peg or the 110% also acts as a price ceiling, because above $1.10, it's profitable to get liquidated. So you just put money down, dump into the market, and get liquidated. And that's how it keeps it below $1.10. And then on the other end, there's a redemption mechanism where you can redeem one stablecoin for $1 worth of collateral, whether you took out the loan or not. So using these invariants, using this $1 kind of baseline, the system is able to kind of guarantee a price range between $1 and $1.10.
Let me go over that again, because that's actually super interesting. So first of all, you said, one of the challenges with stable coins, as we discussed earlier, is keeping it at exactly a dollar or pretty close to a dollar peg, right? So when it loses its peg, just like Terra Luna did, and starts diving down to 50 cents, 40 cents, that's when the land of horror begins and the earth opens up and swallows your stable coin forever. So how do you stop that from happening? Well, you've got two problems. One is, what if your stable coin is worth too much, right? So you don't want that to happen. And the worst one is, what if it's worth too little? So you were saying, what if it becomes worth 90 cents? What if every LUSD on Curve becomes worth 90 cents? Well, you can run over to the protocol to Liquity, and Liquity will at any time hand you $1 worth of ETH for one LUSD. So if LUSD is worth 90 cents, you can make an extra 10 cents worth of ETH on every LUSD that you show up with, right? So people will tend to do that, which will take LUSD off the market and push the peg back up. And then the other scenario is, if it's worth over $1.10 per coin, just take out a loan and get liquidated. You'll make money.
Yeah. It's kind of a system that doesn't require a market maker. It doesn't require a bunch of intelligent arbitragers, because it will handle it on its own. Like, a single bot could handle all the arbitrage without any capital, or with very little capital. And that's the exciting thing about it. And it's very cool.
Yeah. So this is super cool. So Ethos, so you basically modeled Ethos. This is your thing, just to be clear. So really nice user interface, by the way. as I poked around on it. Having now played around with Liquidy LUSD and knowing that your system is an improvement and, you know, sort of based upon it, sort of an improvement, you've made it really easy to see everything and understand everything. So I was actually super impressed with the UI. So this is effectively the same idea as LUSD. So open to the position means give me, well, in your case, you actually will accept ETH, Wrapped Bitcoin, and Optimism, right?
That's right.
Collateral. So this is where you show up with your collateral, and then you can borrow up to roughly 90% of whatever you put in and earn ERN stablecoin. And then this is the stability pool. So if you want to make that 5 to 10% on your earned stablecoins, you put them into the stability pool, and that's where you're – it's effectively like your anchor protocol, kind of a killer app for a stablecoin to make that kind of yield, right? So that's actually quite good. Staking pool is if you own the protocol token for Ethos Reserve, or in Liquidy's case, the LQTY token, which is their governance token, you can also stake it in this pool, and you can also make 5 to 10% on you're basically making it from the same place that the stability pool is on liquidations. So you're basically splitting that amongst the governance token holders and the people that supply you the stable coins. Am I correct so far? Yes,
you are correct.
And your what do I stake here? Because there is no Ethos Reserve coin. It's Oath, right?
Yeah, it's the bonded Oath token, which is 80% Oath and 20% ETH.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so it's not quite the Oath token. You have to go make the... Oh, right. I did see that. I have to go make that on... I forget where, but there's another site where I go to make that.
BeethovenX. It's a decentralized exchange.
Yes. Yep. Okay. So this is where I, you know, so if I look at the collateralization ratio. So Wrapped Bitcoin is one of the coins I can use to actually borrow some ERN. And this shows me that there's, I guess, 30. Oh, sorry, that's the price of Bitcoin. So the collateralization ratio at the moment, you only require 110%. But thankfully, the system is a lot higher than that. It's at 213%.
So for Bitcoin, we require 120. So
oh, you do? Okay.
Explaining how we manage these ratios is kind of like a session in and of itself, but I'll give you a quick 5-second blast here. So there are two ratios. There's the minimum collateral ratio, so that is the absolute most efficient a loan can be. And then there is the the critical collateral ratio. And that is the collateral ratio that as a whole, the minimum that we require the system to be. So for Bitcoin, it's 120% is the minimum, the most amount of LTV you can get, and 150 is the critical number. So it will not allow you to take out a loan if the total collateral ratio of the system is under 150%. And for OP, that number is 180%. So that's why we see these differences in TCR. And for ETH, it's only 120. And we could probably push it even lower as the system matures. But these ratios ensure that while you can get the most efficient loan ever, if your loan isn't that great, or if you don't have a healthy amount of collateral in the system, if the system enters a critical state, it can kind of sideline you. So it can say, hey, we're going to close your position and get you out of the system. And the cool thing about Liquidy is they can close 20 positions in a single click of someone who just knows how to use Etherscan. You know, liquidations are so simple. And I think another cool fact is these systems or these parameters existing is enough to make it so liquidations rarely happen. Redemptions rarely happen because they don't need to happen, because they kind of set boundaries and make it very clear, hey, if you're a user, avoid this mark, avoid that mark. And when you open a position on Ethos, for example, it will light up yellow or it will light up red depending on the numbers you put in. So it'll tell you, hey, if you're going to do this, be aware, we might sideline you. Or, hey, if you're going to do this, be aware, you might get liquidated. And that's generally enough to keep people acting safely. And then if you're a power user, you have all this nice collateral buffer to just hop in and let it rip if you want to get that really, really efficient ratio and micromanage your positions. So it's really about creating an environment to support a huge variety of activity and usage.
Yeah. So your system will tell you, like, if I'm trying to borrow too much against too little, your system will, it'll show red. It'll be like, hey, you're living dangerously. You know, you're speeding.
Yeah.
You know, you can do it, but it's kind of dumb maybe. And, you know, you're likely to be liquidated. And the thing that's interesting about the liquidity model is that you don't have to, you can get liquidated even if you don't dip below the minimum collateralization ratio. So it's 110% in liquidity in Bitcoin. In your system, it's 120%. So if the system enters recovery mode, I'm not sure the conditions under which it can, you know, sort of randomly liquidate you, but it always picks the weakest collateralized debt position to liquidate first. So if you're running close to the red, if you're the weakest animal in the herd, you're going to get hit first. So
if your position, like, it will never liquidate you over the minimum collateral ratio, or it will never liquidate you for an amount over that, but when it does sideline you in the event of a critical scenario, you will experience that marginal loss. So it is, like, in users' best interest to be really healthy, and if they're not going to be really healthy, it's in their best interest to pay close attention.
Yeah, don't float right down near 120%. You know, keep it like at 150%, 180%, whatever.
Yeah. So,
now, question about this: the TCR, the total collateral ratio, that's the amount in all the troves plus whatever's in the stability pool. Is that correct?
No. So that is just the amount in the troves divided by the amount of debt taken on. So all of these different asset pools are isolated. So you have the amount of collateral divided by the amount of debt. That's your TCR, or that is the current collateral ratio, and how it relates to the critical ratio and the minimum ratio at the point of borrowing and as a system as a whole affects what a user can do at a given point. So quite complex, but visualizing it and educating are kind of part of the equation there.
Now,
and the end user, if you're buying ERN off the market, doesn't really have to care.
Right.
This is, like, I kind of look at it in two parts. You have one, the platform, which is for people who know what they're doing. And then you have number two, the token itself, which is for everyone. You can buy that off a market. And then you know that the people on the platform are doing everything correctly, because otherwise the system's like, no, you know, you're out of there. And so you can, you know, rest assured that ERN is a really, really high quality stable coin. And that's kind of, you know, what we're building all of our infrastructure around.
Yeah, because ERN is backed by Bitcoin, Ethereum, and Optimism, and that's it. And by super over collateralized positions and all three of these, and it manages the liquidations in a very smart and slick way. So you can rest assured that this is all very healthy, and you don't have to rely on the fiat banking system, which is super cool. So it's kind of the best of all worlds. So I really love what you've done here. Not to be all, you know, fanboy about it, but yeah, it's good. So, so this is the user interface where you open up a position. I've selected Bitcoin. I've said my collateral is one Bitcoin. So I'm going to borrow $10,000, which is roughly a third of a Bitcoin right now on the open market. So my collateralization ratio is 300%, right? That makes sense, right? There's a little bit of a borrowing fee. So that's Bebas, you know, snaking a little bit out of my pocket right there.
That goes to the bonded oath fellas. It's a collective effort snaking the 50 ERN.
Well, you got to make money somehow. I get it.
And these loans are interest-free, I think, is also a really big one.
Yeah,
so
that's very
good. Building them into a budget is super duper easy.
Yeah, interest-free, whereas on MIM, like, if you remember the MIM thing, so that had very large interest charges. It's like, you know, 10%, 12%. They're very expensive loans, right? Yeah. So this is 0%, which is great. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because how does it make money? Well, it lives on these fees, and then it lives on the liquidations. So now, let's see. So this is the other place where I can I'm depositing. Oh, this is where I get my bonded oath. So if I want to, stake the oath into the staking pool to make my 5-10% on that side, this is where I would do it.
That's right. Now, I think possibly the most important aspect of this system is in one ability. So you mentioned earlier how MIM broke a lot of new ground by taking on interest-bearing assets and giving people the power to lever. And now an issue with that was the protocol was taking on a lot of counterparty risk and taking on a lot of difficult to liquidate positions. Now, what Ethos Reserve has done is it has, much like Liquity originally built the liquidation mechanism into the protocol to make it less risky and more efficient, Ethos Reserve has built the asset management rails and the actual, you know, potential for bearing interest into the protocol. So what Ethos Reserve is able to do is, you know, just like you'd expect from a bank, is it takes all of this collateral underlying, which in any competitor just sits there, you know, farting around, and it can deploy that collateral to an Aave, a granary, or a similar, you know, low risk interest-bearing position being on the supply side of these lending platforms, and generate income that way and generate returns that way. And then it can use that to fund the stability pool, to fund market liquidity, et cetera. So a big problem we see with Liquity is they're very reliant on token emissions, you know, and they kind of follow a Bitcoin model of like a constant rate of decay, you know, to ensure that, you know, there is, you know, continuously some kind of value. But with Ethos Reserve, you know, our assumption is that no token is guaranteed value, especially an ERC-20 token, especially a token that derives its value from a fundamental source, being the staking pool. So by generating these assets, we're able to sustainably maintain indefinitely interest to that stability pool, and thus ensure that ERN and Ethos Reserve can stick around forever. And the nice thing about that is it's able to do it without taking on a crazy amount of counterparty risk, because they're in our actively risk managed, heavily monitored asset management vaults underlying. So mm-hmm. we get the Chainlink Oracle, we get the liquidatability of an ETH token, so none of these weird exotic long tail assets, and everything operates as far as the user is concerned and as far as liquidators are concerned, exactly as normal. But the only difference is now we can manage 50 or 60% of that collateral pool in a really, you know, friendly risk framework, pull out that yield and apply it to different aspects of the system in an effort to scale and in an effort to create sustainability.
Very cool. Well, so just to finish this example. So I've entered into Bitcoin 300%. I really love this. So you told me what my total debt is, my liquidation deposit, and this is the price at which I get liquidated. So if Bitcoin falls to $12,000, boom, that's when I get liquidated. And that's when I get kicked out of the system. However, if the entire overall system enters something that's called recovery mode, I will get liquidated if Bitcoin is worth 15K. So that's sort of an emergency, you know, batten down the hatches. The system is you know, the peg is off. We have to take extreme measures to get everything back into sync again. Let's talk about this recovery mode for a second, because I noticed LUSD had this as well. And you had said previously on another phone call that if there's an emergency, debt is socialized. So how does that happen, and how does that relate to this recovery mode?
Sure. Well, the socialization of debt happens way past recovery mode. It happens in like the apocalypse scenario. But in recovery mode, that's what I was talking about when I said the system is able to sideline a position. If the system is in recovery mode, and let's say the critical collateral ratio is 150%, anybody whose collateral ratio is under 150%, the system will liquidate a portion of the position to pay off your debt, and then sideline, and the rest of your collateral becomes claimable.
Starting with the weakest position. So those who are closest to 120%, they get shot first because they're the weakest animal in the herd.
Yeah, and something that's kind of interesting about this is it actually is an effort and a fairly successful one to prevent cascading liquidations. Because if you have, let's say you have a position, this is how I would collateralize something like Dogecoin or something. Well, Dogecoin is pretty liquid nowadays, but something that's illiquid, something that's toxic. You could have a recovery threshold of, let's say, 400%. And you can have a minimum collateral ratio of, let's say, 110% still. Not only will the system be required to maintain the 400% plus collateralization ratio, but if it falls below that and the system enters recovery mode, it doesn't need to liquidate all, you know, $1,000. It only liquidates up to the minimum threshold and then sidelines the rest. And by doing that, you know, you look at an Aave, you look at a Compound, it'll start liquidating. And that's where you get to get the cascading liquidations. But you could configure this system to potentially liquidate only a small portion of a given position or a given collateral pool, and really, really ease up. And by doing that, it's like you stretch out the dispersion of collateral ratios and of risk profiles, the higher that recovery mode threshold is. So it's a way to kind of program the behavior of system participants, which is super dope.
Okay. Well, we're coming up on the hour here and we don't like to go too much past it, but this has been super fascinating. What would you say the killer app for Earn is, or are you guys still trying to figure that out?
Yeah, well, we're going to work on making the killer app digit.xyz. So it's kind of an app that we've been sitting on for a bit, building infrastructure for, but that will turn ERN into probably the best yielding stablecoin anywhere. And we have a massive grant program with Optimism that will allow us to scale yields and have really nicely compounded yields as the system grows. So digit.xyz, we're going to plug ERN in there. We're going to plug Bonded Oath in there. We're going to have them play together in a really cool fashion. And then we're going to have Oath yield, real yield, options tokens, and all sorts of cool stuff for people to play with on there. And, it's kind of a game of how can we sustainably create the best opportunity possible. And Ethos Reserve, by being able to generate revenue on its underlying assets, can do that 10 times better than anyone else without the reliance on minting tokens. So that's the ultimate goal. And, you know, the nice thing about Ethos is because it's open-ended and because we're able to manage underlying assets, it doesn't really have a shelf life. You look at something like any other CDP platform, and over time, you know, its use cases, especially if it's immutable, will go lower and lower, and its competitiveness will be less and less. But something like Ethos Reserve, it can always have the most competitive yield. It can grow alongside the market and alongside DeFi infrastructure and tech.
So for those who don't know, like say somebody's watching who's not really from our world, when you say manage the underlying assets, so all that Bitcoin, all that Ethereum, all that Optimism, which you as Earn, ERN, have brought into the system as collateral, you're saying you're going to now take that and reinvest it somewhere else in order to get yield, which will eventually, some of that yield will be returned back to holders of ERN tokens or stakers of ERN tokens, correct? So it's yes. Sort of like Silicon Valley Bank investing in treasury bonds, not to use a bad example, because all banks do this, right? But what we learned is that we thought that banks were like Scrooge McDuck's vault, and they're just, your money's just sitting there doing nothing. It's not. It's getting loaned out. You are a forced participant in a hedge fund, which can be a great thing if you are one of those people who reap the rewards. Unfortunately, the real world banks don't share the money they make with us. They only share the debts with us.
Yeah, so it's kind of like, how can we create an over-collateralized, transparent pipeline that distributes that value to the people? And these business models are some of the most successful in history. And I think, our goal with DeFi is to take what works in TradFi, cut out all of the fat, cut out all the greed, cut out all of the, weirdness, I guess, the lack of transparency, and surface that in a public good application that will hopefully be able to exist forever and be enjoyed by our children and our grandchildren and their grandchildren.
So, okay. To our children, children, as the Moody Blues say. So, so just bottom line, as a earn holder, what kind of yield do you think I'll be able to make when this is all up and running?
Well, when it's scaled up, significantly, anywhere from 6 to 10%. Right now you're earning 70%, 60%, just because we're in the process of scaling. You know, we're investing in VE NFTs and similar. But by the time the system is scaled, we have 100 million TVL, interest rate arbitrage happens efficiently. You know, we're gunning for 6 to 10, 6 to 12.
Okay. And now LUSD, if I participate in the stability fund, I can get 5 to 10%, right? So is that, why is yours so close to that? That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Well, 10 to 12 would be us, just using the yield generated underlying. If you add on token emissions like LUSD does, that can go really high. We try to, in our projections, discount token emissions because the goal is to not rely on them.
Real yield, and then whatever else you get is sort of whatever.
Yeah.
Well, listen, Mr. Beavis, I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to say goodbye to Corvallis. He was apparently beamed away from us, but he probably had another thing to go to. But I got to say, like, first of all, this has been super fascinating, and thank you for bearing with my framing and my questions. And the more, honestly, the more I understand about LUSD and this whole stablecoin universe, and particularly digging into your UI and itself, the more impressed I've become. So congratulations on what you built. I wouldn't just say that. I would just say nothing if I didn't feel that way, right? But I honestly do feel that way. So rock on, dude. Well done.
Thank you.
So, okay. Well, that's all the time we have. Justin, thank you for being on the show. My name is Mark Jeffrey. This has been Across the Chains. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, guys.